Hello, listeners. This is Lindsay Fay of the Baker Street Babes, and I want to personally invite you to our annual charity ball. Yay! Held during the Baker Street Irregulars birthday weekend here in New York City. So far, we have raised over $37,000 to benefit wounded soldiers, and we would love to see you at our Silver Blaze-themed Daintiest Filly on the Turf Ball on Thursday, the 10th of January, 2019. Your ticket includes a sit-down, three-course dinner, toasts to canonical war heroes, our raffle, our always baffling quiz, our fabulous costume competition, and of course, culminates in our live auction where you can bid on incredible Sherlockian collectibles. Visit www.bakerstreetbabes.com for all the details and email Lindsay, L-Y-N-D-S-A-Y, at bakerstreetbabes.com if you have any Holmes-related items to donate for war veterans. Thank you, and we hope to see you there.
They call us the Irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street Babes always leave the rest of them behind. So in Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your mind. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you 2-2-1 be mine?
Hello. Sure. Welcome to the Baker Street Babes podcast. This is one of our live and local episodes. This is Lindsay Fay you're listening to, and this is Edgar nominee, among many other things, Michael Sims, and he was nominated this year for Arthur and Sherlock, Conan Doyle, and the Creation of Holmes. He has done a kajillion other things, but I'm just going to highlight the ones that are going to be the most interesting for the Sherlockian nerds. He also has edited things like The Dead Witness, which is a collection of Victorian detective stories, The Penguin Book of Victorian Women in Crime, which I'm purchasing instantly because I didn't know it existed.
Hello.
Yes, thank you. Yes, please. And The Penguin Book of Gaslight Crime. And he writes Sherlockian pastiches. He appears in the Anthony Award-winning anthology In the Company of Sherlock Holmes for his pastiche, as a matter of fact. And he writes brilliant nonfiction, and we are going to get to that in a second. But in order to become an honorary babe, I have to ask you a series of questions.
Okay.
You better get them right.
I'm absolutely ready.
Okay. Who is your favorite character from the Sherlock Holmes mysteries?
Oh, my.
Right?
What's the name of the chief urchin?
Wiggins.
Wiggins.
What a great answer.
Wiggins.
What a fantastic response. Why?
Because he's nobody to anybody in the world. He's invisible.
Mm-hmm.
But Holmes turns to him and tells him what to do, and Wiggins knows, by God, how to make it happen.
I fully believe Holmes sent Wiggins to college. I fully believe that.
Oh, I love this idea.
I have this whole headcanon where when he took the Duke of Holderness's 4,000 pounds, that it was for a very specific purpose and that he sends all the irregulars to school.
Oh, nice.
This is my entire life belief system. I put it in one of my pastiches.
And then they become highly influential in prison reform.
Or they're bank clerks and they you know, have advocacy for people who, you know, need loans and stuff, or they end up librarians, or they end up scholars, or they end up, you know, any number of things.
The father of Archie Goodwin.
Absolutely.
Nero Wolfe's assistant.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you
for bringing that to
a connection.
To a very good conclusion. What is your favorite case from the canon?
I'm not entirely sure why, but a lot of it is the atmosphere. There are two.
Sure.
They're not necessarily Holmes's greatest moments,
but there's something about
the atmosphere and the images that stayed in my mind.
Sure.
One is Boscombe Valley Mystery.
I love Boscombe Valley.
I just love that.
I love it.
Some of my first images of him are from that, and his stretching out on the ground, examining with his magnifying glass, and and how that turned out to be, of course, as always, misinterpreted by everyone at first. Mm-hmm. So I love that one. And I have a prop here in this room that is a textbook from my middle school, mm-hmm. where I discovered Sherlock Holmes and Edgar Allan Poe in the same, they're the first two stories in this lit collection. I was, I think, 12 or 13. And at the end of the one about Edgar Allan Poe, it talks about the Edgars. So I've known about the Edgars before I knew about any other literary organization.
Before you were nominated for one.
Roughly 45 years or more, 48 years.
Well, you're not that old.
I turned 60 in February.
That's not true.
No. So,
all respect.
So that's
happy birthday.
Speckled Band.
Oh, yeah.
And also,
first one I ever read.
And I learned, it introduced me to the whole thing. And it's all the animals and the annotations in the back of that lookbook introduced me to the idea of Sherlockian unpacking, that you unpack the stories behind it. And it made history open up and cease to be opaque. And the key was that there's a little thing at the end of it that talks about Arthur Conan Doyle's snake could not have done all these things.
Well, he certainly couldn't drink milk.
Yes, or answer a whistle.
No, or answer a whistle, because snakes are deaf.
Yes, and so that made me...
We sometimes refer to him among the babes as Sir Arthur Continuity Doyle.
Yes, so he really needed a continuity editor. He really did.
Yeah.
Just like even all the fun that different people in the BSI have had giving papers on how Watson was contorted in such a position to wind up with both a shoulder wound and a leg wound, or all those things.
How was time mucked with in a Star Trek fashion so that Holmes solved a case in 1892 when he was dead?
Yes.
We don't know.
All these wonderful things. And then you get Rex Stout later doing Watson Was a Woman.
Yep.
And just wonderful stuff.
Fantastic things. Okay, so this is a completely different question. Than the first one I asked. Which character from the canon would you most like to sit down over tea with and just talk, gossip with?
Ooh. Well, I like Watson's tone so much that you know he'd be more sarcastic to talk to than you would think.
He'd be snarky.
And as he gets older and he says, like in Valley of Fear, I think I'm the most long-suffering. Because I would think, and Holmes goes, that's an excellent idea. You should try that.
Yeah.
That kind of tone.
Yeah. So, or the tone like, I'm a bedpost. Whatever.
Yes, yes. And so that we know that Watson would be more revealing and livelier and more sarcastic than he's often presented.
Certainly. I think sitting down for a cream tea with Watson would be incredible.
And Holmes, of course, would be like the difference in having coffee with Einstein or Einstein's assistant. Mm. You know, Einstein's assistant's going to have all the backstage stories.
Oh, yeah.
But there are so many. Oh, there's so many great characters.
It feels like you picked Watson, though. It's the one you went to first. I think we'll stick with it because it was the one that your mind connected with immediately. Who's going to know Sherlock Holmes the most intimately? Dr. John Watson.
And that's part of what I love about the difference between Conan Doyle's narrator and, say, Poe's in The Murders in the Rue Morgue, whose nameless narrator who just fawns and worships.
Yeah.
And you learn nothing, but they start as two young men trying to find a cheap place to live.
I could not agree more. And I think that the vividness and the real, actual, just visceral... Instead of in a contrived intellectual sense, the visceral love that Dr. Watson has for his friend is so beautiful, and it's just marvelous. And it starts as early as A Study in Scarlet, which we will get to when we talk about your book, because A Study in Scarlet was not particularly successful, as we know. But. There's a phrase in Study in Scarlet that I can't get away from where he says, readers will set me down as a hopeless busybody if I admit how fascinated I was by this man.
Yes.
And he is. And isn't that what any sort of iconoclastic, brilliant figure just wants? Is somebody to stand there and say, okay, well, you're being a pain in the ass, but I'll still be here tomorrow.
Yes. Yes. I love that. And he serves as then a conduit to the reader.
Mm-hmm.
And he's skeptical before we are, because Holmes is a sort of a superhero.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to be skeptical. We're going to be skeptical that he's a genius or whatever.
Watson's and a ninja and a boxer.
And a ninja and a boxer. And he can Straighten and pokers. Grimesby Roylott, right?
Thank you for bringing
the
up the poker.
Name because of all time.
It is the best name of all time, but thank you for bringing up the poker because 100% of Baker Street Babes agree that is the silliest thing and the best thing ever to happen.
Yes.
You're welcome.
And you think about, people say, how does Sherlock Holmes be, how is he such a protean character? And you've been incarnated in so many ways, even in our own era, elementary, Sherlock, etc.
Absolutely.
And you think, well, just pick a channel.
Yeah.
You want somebody who does bare knuckle boxing and twist and untwist posters? Okay, we've got, or pokers, we've got him.
Yeah.
You want somebody who's an intellectual genius who pummels corpses to see how much the bruises change after death? We got that too. Somebody who's on the spectrum, done.
It's all of these things. It's all of the above. And our motto is all Holmes is good Holmes. And you just naturally segued in a brilliant way into the final question. The final question is, what is your favorite of all the Sherlock Holmes adaptations? This is not casting aspersions on any others. It just means, which one is the one that is the closest to what you want to see in your head?
I would say, I seem to be pretty particular about these, and sometimes I don't even want to see a favorite fictional character incarnated in a movie. Or I think, I'm not sure I'm even going to pursue that. So, but Benedict Cumberbatch has incredible charisma. Like you'd watch him read the phone book, as they say.
He's fantastic, yeah.
But and Elementary is pretty mesmerizing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still Jeremy Brett.
Still Jeremy.
He's still the man who, it's as if he went off stage and he drank all of the original stories and novels,
yeah,
and distilled them into like his blood.
Mm-hmm.
And the only other time I've seen anybody do that, I mean, W.C. Shea is a great Poirot.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, the only other thing is the A&E series about Nero Wolfe, where
Maury
Chaykin was Nero Wolfe and Timothy Hutton was Archie Goodwin. And I think that's
fantastic.
The only thing I can think of that's
when Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie played Jeeves and Worcester. And then you're like, oh.
Yes. Okay.
In a completely different genre.
And a whole different cosmos.
Right. But it's not a whole different cosmos because Stephen Fry wrote a Sherlock Holmes pastiche because Stephen Fry is obsessed with the Sherlock Holmes mysteries. And Hugh Laurie played Sherlock Holmes when he did House MD. So it's not that long a walk.
Oh, you're right. This is like Robert Steck's stuff about here's the Jeopardy question. How does this relate to all of Sherlock Holmes?
Yeah.
And it's is everything just maybe only two steps, not six.
Not 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon.
Yes.
And by the way, I have met Kevin Bacon, so you are now 1 degree.
1 degree
from Kevin
Bacon.
I
like this.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome. This is the sort of thing that will stay.
And then, last night I met Lawrence Block, just barely for 10 seconds. So
no,
here's the name dropping.
No, Larry's awesome.
And I thought, okay, now I'm connected with a lot of the people he met over the years.
Oh, you are.
I'm 1 degree away from that.
Yep.
It's like you shake the hand of whoever.
That's incredible.
I love that.
I love that too. Okay. So we're going to talk about specific things to do with your book in a moment. But first, I really want to ask the question. There are so many books about Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, about Sherlock Holmes, about Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes, about the creation of Sherlock Holmes, about the mythology of Sherlock Holmes. Several of them exist. As a matter of fact, two of them were nominated this year because they're both so outstanding. Yours and Matthias Bostrom's From Holmes to Sherlock. So much critical attention has been paid to this because Sherlock Holmes is actually shorthand in our language for detective. If you put a deerstalker or a magnifying glass and a pipe on the side of a truck, then you know it's a surveillance-like team. You know that it's home security. You know that they're...
That's a very good point.
The shorthand of it has absolutely leaked into universal language to the point that Sherlock Holmes is ubiquitous. So I want to know how you approached this book because you wanted to say something that had not been said previously.
It's a question that comes up in various interviews of Pamela Paul, when she interviewed me for the New York Times about this, said... That's close to this question.
Well, I'm just as good as a New York Times interviewer.
See, that's what I'm saying. You are the two people who said, let's go behind what made you think you had something new to say.
Sure.
And As I mentioned, I discovered Sherlock Holmes at like the age of 12 or whatever. So I hate to rush. So
I like to let things
percolate for decades.
Sure.
I don't realize that, but then I look around and think it took me forever to enjoy. It has to be a topic that sort of saturates me.
Absolutely.
Like I'm doing one now on the young Charles Darwin because I've been obsessed with him my whole life. Mm-hmm. But so I had to let the Sherlock stuff sort of, I be there and become part of my life. And then I go around and read all these things. I didn't realize this was happening. But in retrospect, I would read things or I'd go looking for information and I would think, wait, they're leaving out this part. And there are great analytical pieces and all great things. And Matthias Bostrom's book is fabulous. And it's the whole cultural history of the Sherlock phenomenon. So we have about 20 pages of overlap. His beginning of the story is the part that I open up into a different book. So he goes on and covers the whole phenomenon beautifully. And it was great to finally meet him over the last couple of days here in town. So eventually I looked around and thought, I'm seeing a different way to do this. I want it to be like my book about Henry David Thoreau, The Adventures of Henry Thoreau, or a book about the origins of Charlotte's Web and E.B. White's, E.B. White's whimsical approach to nature and his wild creative imagination. I had to go into how his brain worked. And then with Henry Thoreau, I wanted to expand into the community of the transcendentalists and what it was sounded like to walk down a street in Concord. So I thought one of the things I want to do is make it a narrative as novel-like as possible without a single fictional adjective. Although, as you brought up in the symposium a couple of days ago, the question is how reliable are primary witnesses?
Correct. Michael's referring to a panel that we did yesterday here at the Eggers 2018. And essentially, it was a bunch of brilliant nonfiction authors talking about ways that they would research things and ways that they would try to always get things meticulously correct. And I stood up like a dick. And I said, as someone who writes historical fiction, but very heavily researched stuff, I said, I come across a lot of narrators who are full of shit.
Yes.
They're primary sources. Absolutely. But are they right? Well, you know, their opinions on Irish Catholics immigrating,
yes,
or on people of color or on queers or on any number of things are maybe a little bit off kilter. So then I asked the question, hey, you've got a primary source. Is it right? And Michael,
How trustworthy is it?
And Michael brilliantly riffed off of this.
So I want to mention that sort of example again, which is that I mentioned this in the notes, you know, that I'm fully aware that none of this was recorded on film at the time, obviously.
Yeah.
So
it's not on YouTube.
Yes, although there's that beautiful late in life, tiny, tiny interview with Arthur Conan Doyle on film.
Yes.
That's a wonderful thing.
No, that's marvelous.
That's marvelous. But so there's no confirmation of exactly how accurate. But the thing that occurred to me is, and I mentioned this in the notes, that when I found dialogue in a primary source, I wanted to use it.
And I want to insert a tiny parenthetical here, which was that one of his co-panelists, who shall remain nameless, mentioned that he made up exactly two lines of dialogue in his work of non-fictional, you know, heavily researched. He said, I assumed that this character at some point, this real life person, of course, at some point would have said regarding this other person, call her. It was two words. He inserted it into the narrative, and the look of horror on Michael's face cannot be reproduced. It was like he was looking at a graphic traffic accident on the side of the road. Like there's this car on fire. And I was like, Michael, turn your face down.
Your look was, keep it together. Keep it together.
I'm looking at Michael from across a crowded room in the audience. Keep it together.
And I received the signal and tried to shut down the face like, I'm going to lower the blinds.
I'm like, don't do this face.
Because I almost blurted into the microphone.
No!
From my point of view, and I love narrative nonfiction as much as I love novels.
Sure.
But from my point of view, I wanted to say, also just to snark up the conversation, nonfiction with two made up words is creative fiction. And
sure.
But I didn't really mean that. But also, I like his ideas of this nameless person we're discussing.
This nameless person.
About the blend of it.
And just protecting
Truman Capote.
Protecting that person's identity.
Yeah, and Truman Capote, the nonfiction novel idea,
sure,
and so many things. And the whole creative nonfiction idea. But for me, I want it to be absolutely as accurate in source as I can get for every single thing. So I will write a sentence, and I mentioned that in doing the research, I don't want to make a bunch of notes and come back later. I want the research to be made immediately into sentences. I write it into it as sentences. It doesn't matter if it fits with anything else yet. And then I footnote that sentence. And sometimes there will be four footnotes for a single sentence. And I'll bullet down to one for the notes in the back of the book. And so I passionately want every single thing to be right. And so if I say that, as I mentioned, Arthur Conan Doyle replied angrily, and I think, It sounds angrier, but was I right?
Right? And do I need an adverb here?
Yeah, so you have to take that off and think, yeah. Maybe not. But then at the same time...
What if you said Sir Arthur Conan Doyle replied bitchily, and you just and you just assume that that's probably true?
Bitchy old fart that he had become by then. Yes. Arthur Conan Doyle replied, see...
To everything.
To everything. I don't bloody fucking think so.
Yes, exactly. No.
So,
none of that will be edited.
No. Oh, good.
Oh, no, we drop F-bombs on this podcast constantly.
Yeah, actually, come to think of it, I thought, yes, no, I know where I am. I'm
oh,
here.
For fuck's sake, you're cool. Oh.
FFS is one of the great abbreviations of our era.
No, the great abbreviation of our era is my cousin, who will be like, S of a bitch. And you abbreviate the wrong thing.
And then we could just go off on a little alcove about creative cursing.
Absolutely.
And slang.
But Stephen Fry's not here, so we can't. We have to talk about Arthur and Sherlock.
Yes. Okay. Well, I'm okay about it.
And normally, I would want to go off on that detour, but you have to meet with Penguin. So, and there's a lot to discuss here.
Yes. Thank you.
Much to unpack. So let's talk about Dr. Joseph Bell for a bit, because you start with Dr. Joe, as he was called, Bell. I love the familiar terminology that everybody seemed to like him. Everybody seemed to want to be around him. He seems mesmeric, sort of in the same way Sherlock Holmes was.
Yes.
Was off-putting, but mesmeric. And Watson talks about this sort of almost hypnotic effect that Holmes has on people. And it seems to me, looking at your anecdotes, that Bell had the same effect on people.
He seemed to a lot of people, and then later a lot of other students. Part of what I wanted was confirmation of other students' accounts of how he behaved, and some quote dialogue and things like this. So that really helps. And texture about how he walked and how his voice was because of having had diphtheria, and it had changed his voice and caused his limp and everything else. But also, Arthur Conan Doyle was coming back from boarding school, as you know. Mm-hmm. He'd just come back home to Edinburgh, and he's only 17. And his dad's an alcoholic and very troubled and already at the stage where he would be caught drinking furniture polish and could barely climb up off the floor at times.
Yep.
So Arthur very much needed a hero and a father figure. And I think in the roughly a decade between when he first met Joseph Bell and he began to conjure him as a detective, he had sort of made him into a superhero in his mind. Because the letters, as you know, and the beautiful letters to his mother in that John Lillenberg big, beautiful anthology. I mean,
Sashauer, too.
Sashauer.
Yeah, Dan and John. Mm-hmm.
And someone else. A third person who,
Martin.
Please forgive us.
No. No, I think that was Lillenberg and Sashauer.
Oh, was that? Okay.
Yeah. All Hail. It's a beautiful collection.
Yeah, and neither one of whom I've ever met, but both of whom have done work I greatly admire. And in that collection of letters, mostly to his mother, you see all kinds of references to Bell, and then in other accounts, and then later when The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes is published, and he dedicates it to my old friend Joseph Bell.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to end on that note, but also Bell was...
You almost bookend, like, the book with Bell, and it's such a through line because...
Oh, good.
Yeah,
good.
It's such a through line.
I wanted...
It has so much resonance.
I wanted Bell and Arthur Conan Doyle's father, Charles Altamont Doyle, to be the main secondary characters.
Sure.
And Bell was the huge, accomplished, I can get through anything figure. He conquered diphtheria. He conquered a limp. He conquered almost totally losing his voice.
They were very contrastual figures in Doyle's life.
They really were. And I thought this heroic figure occupies Doyle's imagination over the years. And his father is like a shadow figure of failure.
Yeah,
he never achieves the success even of his brother and father in the visual arts. And he drinks more and more, and then he winds up in various asylums. And I really wanted it in part, and also in his life, Arthur Conan Doyle's mother was incredibly influential.
Mary. And then you see the birds to a lighthouse phrase, and you think, oh, of course Mary Morstan is named Mary.
Of course she is.
Right, of course she is.
But at the same time, as I hope I emphasized in this, I'm concentrating on the creation of Sherlock Holmes. She was huge in his life, but she wasn't huge in really, I think, in the factors that created Holmes as a character. But
no,
I
she doesn't seem to have been.
And of course, Bell was.
I think his father was, too,
his
to be
father
honest with
was.
You.
And so I tried to weave those together and keep them moving through the background of the rest of the story so that as Arthur Conan Doyle's star rises so quickly, his father's just really crashing. And he winds up dying of that. And that was another reason, in a sense, to stop the book where I did with the publication of Arthur and with The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes.
Yes.
Because it could be the dedication back to Bell. But also, if we go about a year or two further along, we get Doyle already getting tired of Holmes.
That's a whole different book.
And that's a whole different book.
Yeah.
And his and he kills off Holmes. And Tui, his wife, is discovered to have tuberculosis.
Correct.
And all these things. And I had to find a moment that it had to get through a study in Scarlet, the Sign of Four, and the first collection of
stories.
And
the adventures. And you had to find this marvelous stopping point where this is almost the golden age right here.
Yes. And yes, that's it.
Yeah.
And the ancient, like Hesiod and Homer and everything, that kind of golden age. The golden age ended, in a sense, when all the creation was finished.
Yes.
Because the golden age is still being, they're the first gods, they're the titans or whatever,
yes.
And they're still creating the cosmos. And so I wanted to stop at the point where I felt like he had really finished tinkering with the character.
The cosmos was finished and he hadn't got tired of it.
Yes. So he wasn't even to the seventh day where he wanted to rest.
No, he didn't want to rest. Yeah,
I think I've worked this metaphor to death.
No, I think that Arthur and Sherlock is God on day six. And he's like, well.
Yes.
Resting off his hands.
And I want to close on day six, not on day seven.
Not
and
on
it's
day
like,
seven.
I don't any painter like Picasso, you want to do the young Protean Picasso.
Sure.
Rather more than the bitter misogynistic asshole that he became.
Absolutely. You don't want to do dick face Picasso. That is not any fun. You have so many anecdotes in this book. This is one that I found particularly charming. You have so many details, and I want to talk about ways in which you found them, delved into them, because everybody's going to be listening to this and think, Michael Sims does incredible research. Where does he get his, where do we get this level of crack? Like, it's so good. But
it is crack. It's addictive.
It's so addictive, and I completely agree with you. So I use newspapers a lot and diaries and other things that I kind of archivally find. But that's not supposed to be an adverb, but let's leave it there.
I like it.
And you have this anecdote about Sir Arthur Conan Doyle played the tuba in band.
In band in Germany.
What?
Yes.
Okay, so I read
and
this
wait,
and I'm
what
like,
was that giant tuba called? There was a German word for this giant tuba.
I have no idea.
And he was like barely strong enough to carry it. And one
just
time
the picture, the mental image, and I'm doing this purely for the sake of the Baker Street Babes listeners because we have a wide range. So now picture everyone. We all like to have a good laugh. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle playing the tuba in band. At band practice.
And in the cartoon version, he already has a walrus mustache that's sort of blowing up every time he blows the horn. Yeah. And his fellow students stuffed it with pillows.
Yes.
So that one morning he goes in and it's like boom and there's no sound. And just those kinds of details and also what Edinburgh Medical School looked like.
Yeah.
And felt like. And when I found the detail that someone there at the time had written about, that the curving staircases were thronged with students, and they described what they looked like. And I looked at a lot of photos of the students, including Conan Doyle at that time. But also that the students would part like the Red Sea for nurses. It took two nurses to carry someone in a sedan chair up and down the stairs.
Sure.
There were no ramps. They weren't doing the regular wheelchairs up and down stairs. So they were picking someone up. It took two strong nurses.
Mm-hmm.
And so these students in their ties, their walking sticks tapping on the cobblestones, they come in, just the image of that, and then they part to make room for people going up.
It's amazing.
Just those kinds of details or what, like he wrote into early stuff, the view from his window upstairs at Bush Villas.
Yeah.
And you think, and the rain, and he could smell the ground out there, and you look at the photos of him there. And well, you know, you write historical fiction.
I do, but
this is one
of the reasons I like your work so much is because I'm always thinking on a five sense memory level because that's good writing, and I'm like, well, but what did it smell like?
Yes,
you know, I get that that's what they said.
Yes, yes.
But what did it sound like, and what did it smell like, and
I did
what
that
was
with
the
Henry,
weather like?
With Henry David Thoreau in his cabin.
Absolutely.
Like, what did the cabin smell like?
Yeah.
You know, and he was like 28, and you think it would probably smell
like
a dorm room.
It smelled like a dude who thought that he hugged trees better than you hug trees, and then goes to Emerson's house to have dinner cooked for him.
That's what it felt like. But he also, and he was always, like, he helped build the house his parents lived in, and he was always going back and forth. And he became a major businessman when his dad died. He ran the pencil business that he had helped renovate. So anyway, all this cool stuff.
Pencil shavings. It smelled like
pencil. Yeah, it smelled like pencil shavings. But also then you learn that there was, he first built this cellar. So it smelled like bare earth. And he even describes what it took to dig down through the different layers. And so I wanted to do that again with Arthur Conan Doyle as much as possible. So
you make it very visceral, like in the scene when he and Dr. Bell are looking at a corpse. He's about to touch the corpse. And then Dr. Bell's like, don't touch it. No, just look at it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And the medical students are like, looking at this, you know, just cadaver laying out there, and they're wanting to, you know, investigate further. And Dr. Bell's like, no, like, don't, you can examine it. Don't touch it though.
Yes.
Use your senses. Like,
yes.
Observe, use all of your senses, read this, and then start to move it around. But don't move it around before you've engaged all your senses in order to figure out what's going on.
And all of Conan Doyle's very early articles on photography. He became a huge fan early on. Well, I mean, it had been announced as an invention in 1839, so it wasn't like brand new. It wasn't like, hey, we have cell phones. But it was...
You're welcome.
He was still very, very innovative. He was wanting to try new things. And so I wanted, like, where did he go and what did he photograph? And so I read all his early articles that went to, like, the British Journal of Photography or whatever it was called.
Yeah.
And what kinds of birds he photographed on what places. So then I was going to need half a sentence on what that island looked like.
Of course.
So you dig up for that. And then also that he had a very heavy camera and he had a heavy monopod pole that he designed himself to screw into the base of it with a particular kind of spike that would go into the soil. Okay. One sentence of that tells you he's always tinkering. He's always going to make it happen. Mm-hmm. But also, it gives me the visual image of that spike going into the loamy soil of the island with the cormorants calling. And then it wakes up for me.
Don't you say it at a certain point that that when he was a young man, he went hiking in the Alps, this was just for a vacation, with a very heavy-tipped walking stick?
Yes.
Like a hiking pole. But
yes.
It was heavy as fuck.
Yes.
And he was doing it because, like, this is a man's
stick. And he was showing off a man's stick, like the... Like Michael McIntyre's comedy routine on the man drawer.
Sure.
It was like
the Washington Monument.
Yes, exactly. So you have this giant, heavy alpenstock kind of thing.
And he's then like, also, how much weight can I put on this alpenstock?
Yes, and you know, you see that with, he's always proving himself to himself. He doesn't have much of a dad model. He's always... He wants to prove things to others somewhat and to himself. He's not like Teddy Roosevelt going, I'm manly and I'm off in the mountains, but I happen to bring a photographer with me.
Yeah.
You know, he's not that bad.
No, he's...
But he does, like, you know, it's like the tuba because he thought the clarinet was not manly.
No, he
picked the tuba because it's the biggest damn thing.
Tuba's for wizards. Excuse me, anything else is for wizards.
Yes, this is huge. Yeah. It takes a lot of air.
Brawn. Yeah, man, this is a man's
instrument. And damn you kids for putting pillows in here. It makes it comic.
And then he's like, I have a mustache, motherfuckers.
Yes. And he admits that he grew one to look more adult.
Yeah.
And then he admits, like, in Southsea, that he is at Portsmouth. He's looking through the wooden blinds. He's standing there, wooden blinds tilted, staring down, counting the number of people who come by to see the sign that says Dr. Conan Doyle, surgeon.
That's amazing.
And those
moments. He's very self-conscious.
And then in a separate thing, he mentioned wooden blinds. And so here he sees, he's looking through the blinds. And then he talks about the street and then where the sign hung, we can tell from the photos.
Sure.
So you take all those little, as you do.
Yeah, and then you piece them together.
And then, so he's standing there looking through the wooden blinds. And those are the moments of insecurity. I keep coming back to, I'm very interested in people who accomplish, but in their genesis phase, where they, I want to restore the suspense. I want it to be novel-like in that they didn't know they'd amount to anything.
No.
They didn't even know if they'd live through the day. They have the same suspense we have. Mm-hmm. Some crazy motherfucker was was running their country.
Absolutely.
Everybody was being mean and hurting each other. And
sure.
They want to live a life and try to not be jackasses.
Yeah.
And accomplish something.
100%.
And now he's a god.
And now he's a god. This is the quote that I think that ties into something that I still want to talk about because I think that we haven't touched on all of it yet. And it's very fertile ground, but also dovetails with what you were just saying. You have a quote from Memories and Adventures, which was one of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's, you know, many autobiographical works.
And great title.
Great title, right? Memories and Adventures, because that's what my life is.
Hey. I'll not be more imaginations yes. and planning.
Right? Imaginations and planning. So it's the beginning of chapter 8, and he says, several times in my life, I have done utterly reckless things with so little motive that I have found it difficult to explain them to myself afterward. And I find that quote very interesting, because as much as Sherlock Holmes is absolutely, his skills and his talents are based on Joseph Bell, I think that when you read Sherlock Holmes, and if you've ever looked through a collection of Charles Altamont Doyle's artwork, which I have.
Beautiful stuff.
Beautiful, stunning, and very sort of almost, for me, recognizable. If you have ever looked at his material and looked at descriptions of Holmes in which Sir Arthur is referring to him as, oh, well, he would have periods of manic energy and then he wouldn't talk for 3 days. Or, you know, he did morphine, but also, excuse me, he did cocaine, but also morphine. And Sherlock Holmes using cocaine as an example of something that he says is stimulating and clarifying yeah. to the mind. Sure, I'll give you that. I know a lot of lawyers. But morphine is not. That's something to turn things off.
Yeah.
And
I flatlined in an ER once because they gave me an overdose of morphine. After a car wreck.
Christ. My God.
So I'm back. Well, I've already died once. I've learned to walk three times. Christ.
No, that's not totally irrelevant.
I'm morphine for a weird hyperlink. I just clicked on it.
That is absolutely not irrelevant, because there's a reason that we're all drawn to these stories of adventure and near death and circumstance and happenstance. What might occur to a person during their lifetime? And I actually think that is very, you know, telling. It adds texture to what you've already written. But
then in one tiny parenthesis, I was once in a car chase where I was being chased by someone who was firing a gun.
Okay.
And
I have two questions.
That's why
right
I
now.
Left my tiny county in eastern Tennessee, because I was like, this shit's over. I'm out of here.
This shit's over. I have two questions right now. One of all, were you hit with any bullets from this gun?
No, nor was the car.
Okay.
So it made me think they were firing into the air, but they kept chasing.
Two of all, since you were not in fact hit and neither was the car, is it okay for me to think this is awesome?
It is, yes. It's sort of like what mystery and crime fiction people admit to themselves when they think there's no microphone on, and now we're foolishly going to say here.
Yep.
You think, well, if the world, you don't want anything bad to happen to anyone.
Sure.
But if somebody's going to die like three blocks away, why can't you be the one who finds the body?
For sure.
And then you
Absolutely.
Feel so guilty for that horrible feeling.
Yeah.
So, yes, it's... I didn't die, so it was awesome.
So it was awesome.
Like so many things.
Yes, exactly.
I totally distracted you. Back to my
No, brain. You did not. You did not, because I just quoted Sir Arthur saying, there are many near-death, reckless things that I have taken my life in my hands a number of times, he essentially admitted. And I think that that is certainly not something that is indicative of Joseph Bell's character. He seems to have led a life of some circumspection and caution. And I think that
shaped by willpower.
Shaped by willpower and pure force of will. And I think that this wild card bit might have come from somebody who was descended from Charles Altamont Doyle and who had seen what that looked like and who had, you know, there's a bit of a turbulent spirit going on underneath some of these things.
I like that. Turbulent spirit's a phrase I wish I had thought to use in the book.
You can use it in your next
book. I'll add it in the paperback.
Okay.
Oh, the paperback comes out next month.
Then you can't add it. It's definitely already printed.
Oh, and we were talking about this last night at the Eggers, that I want to start producing t-shirts for writers that say, okay, I'll fix it in the paperback.
Oh!
I could probably sell thousands of these.
I'll buy one.
Okay.
Make a ladies slim cut V-neck. I'm there.
Okay. And then there'll be some that say you have to be this tall to ride this ride and things like that.
Sure.
So I have no idea why that occurred to me.
I think there's an intersection between Joseph Bell and Charles Doyle, wherein Sir Arthur maybe was not intending to put his life and his parental father figures into Sherlock Holmes, but they're both there.
I think so.
Would you agree with that?
Please
expound on that question.
I think he was frustrated, as we all know, all of the real, you know, the fanatics of fan of Short Kryptonitic, as we demonstrate, that he was frustrated with Sherlock Holmes after a while, that he was known best for Sherlock Holmes. But it's sort of like Peter Falk being frustrated that he was known for Columbo. And you want to go, come on, you run, you know, you own that sphere completely.
Yeah.
So let it go.
And what more do you want?
What more do you want, my man? So, but I think that he let his inner adolescent self go, his hero worship of Joseph Bell, and the dark weirdness of his dad and everything else. And even in the first of the Professor Challenger books, he does it again. Mm-hmm. You can't get more Robert Louis Stevenson inner adolescent than The Lost World.
That's true.
And so,
including the title.
Yes, yes, all magical, like Treasure Island, The Lost World. Or when I was a kid, I couldn't resist anything they had The Secret of or The Mystery of in the title.
Yep.
Especially my favorite, the Secret of Treehouse Island.
The Secret of Treehouse Island?
Yeah, I read that when I was a kid.
Where do I get that?
It's the best title of all time. So I do think that all of that was in there much more than he realized, much more than he wanted.
Well, authors don't realize it.
Because he was channeling himself. But then he would do almost didactic things like The White Company, where it had to be carefully historically researched. It had to be this and that.
And he thought that was quote unquote good.
That was the good important stuff. And Robert Downey Jr. does not exactly have The White Company option. I think it's worth betting.
He doesn't, but he nails the fuck out of Sherlock Holmes.
Yes, and a whole different Sherlock Holmes. He occasionally loses his accent.
Mm-hmm. Just everyone.
Just it comes in and out. No. Yeah. I do think that he was always revealing more than he thought. But that it was also like Don Marquis, who created Archie and Mehitabel, those characters in 1916, the free verse poet reincarnated as a cockroach and the cat who claimed to have been Mehitabel and puts them loose on the streets of New York. And later he was bemoaning over like a 3-martini lunch with Christopher Morley. I'm only known as the creator of a goddamn cockroach, is how he put it.
Well, so is Kafka, but.
But you think, yeah, very Kafka, but you think. You didn't realize you were laboring. He has this painful, Marquis does, painfully solemn and tedious play about the resurrection.
Oh,
and you think,
let's leave that on the shelf.
Go back to your talking cockroach.
It's like when T.S. Eliot decided he was going to just write Catholic poetry. And you're like, really?
Yes.
Really?
Or for me, as someone who gets somewhat impatient with religion in general, it's like, C.S. Lewis, go back through the wardrobe.
C.S.
Yeah.
Fonz.
Clive, my man.
More Mr. Tumnus.
Yes. And with Arthur Conan Doyle, the same thing. And also, you know, we all like to sit around talking about Sherlock Holmes and say, and then after a while, or the more solemn commentators, which do not include us, of course, will say, and then after a while, Conan Doyle caved in to public pressure and reincarnated Sherlock Holmes and said he didn't die at the Reckonbach Falls. And you think, no, he missed the money.
He missed the money.
of course he missed the money.
This is true. Another example of this.
He did miss Holmes.
Very parenthetically, another example of this is I have read Lord of the Rings probably 50 times.
And I never finished
approximately.
It.
I love Lord of the Rings, but I've read the Silmarillion approximately one half of one time.
Yes.
So I'm like, yes, why don't we have a very dry recounting of all of the mythology that you're using in it? And, and to fans of the Silmarillion out there, including my little brother, Johnny, I'm so sorry.
Yes, please forgive us.
We apologize. But I always draw this correlation between Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and Shakespeare, because they needed a buck at the end of the day.
Sure.
And there's something to be said for commercial writing, if you're brilliant, because they were both brilliant. And they were like, all right, well, I would like to go to the bar tomorrow, and I would like to pay my rent. So, and what do you want to see?
And you think about that. So it's like, you want some clowns? Graveyard scene? I got it.
Clowns.
And Doyle would do this. Like Doyle brings, he sits there and he writes in that tight little nice handwriting. Mm-hmm. And he brings his sister home from being a governess in Portugal by doing that. And then he builds a big house. He buys a beautiful old house in Norwood. Then he builds a beautiful house. And you think, all conjured out of the air. And Shakespeare, the same thing. And you know, the Oxfordians and others are mad that a common man of the streets could conjure this magic. But Arthur Conan Doyle did. Robert Louis Stevenson did, who, by the way, I was glad to work in here, studied with Joseph Bell about 9 years before Arthur Conan Doyle did.
That's such an amazing intersection.
My favorite moment in this is when Robert, at the very end, Robert Louis Stevenson reads The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, thanks Conan Doyle, who apparently sent it to him, and says, by the way, is this my old friend Joe Bell? And you think he recognized him however many years later as the original source. And that's another clue of how closely Doyle based it on it.
Absolutely.
I love stuff like that.
I love stuff like that, too. I love your quote from Arthur, every writer is imitative at first. I think that is an absolute rule, though sometimes he throws back on some model which is not easily traced.
Yes.
And then we get to sit here tracing
and it.
And trace it.
And now here is a great, weird, like we're doing T.S. Eliot and Kafka and everything else.
Sure.
Here's a great connection. Vladimir Nabokov said one of his favorite writers that he read in English when he was like a trilingual 5-year-old probably already.
He was too. Let's
German,
be real.
Yeah, too. He was a German governess and, you know, yeah. And he was reading the same American adventure writer that inspired Arthur Conan Doyle, Mayne Reid, who I think was like Irish-American, I forget, but that he was writing these adventure stories about the Rockies and all this stuff. And that's what Arthur Conan Doyle is reading at about, let's see, 1870.
Yeah.
When he's 11. And Nabokov is reading at, say, 1915.
That's incredible.
It's wild.
It's fantastic.
How these seeds, it's they find seeds in a sarcophagus in the Metropolitan Museum, and
sure,
the seeds are 2,000 years old, but they still germinate.
They still work.
That's how I think of literature.
That's so beautiful. And I could not agree with you more, because we can imagine, we can look forward ourselves. Let's not even look forward 50 years. Let's look forward 100 years and imagine that we're not all underwater. So we live on an ocean. And
we live in a cross between water world and Trumpistan.
Something like that, exactly. But we still have books. And there are still going to be, people who were 8 or 10 or 12 or however old you are. And I was 10 and picking up Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
And reading Sherlock Holmes for the first time. And I can envy those people,
yes,
who are going to read Sherlock Holmes, because Sherlock Holmes is not going anywhere. And that's a beautiful thing to have made.
And again, it wasn't what Doyle thought would be his lasting contribution. But he channeled something really, he had great talent. I think about this, like George Eliot is a time machine.
Sure.
Because she conjured the texture and the smells and everything of her era.
Yeah, she's marvelous.
Jane Austen is a distilled dandelion wine, in that you've got beautiful psychology and beautiful,
absolutely,
speech, mm-hmm, but they can take a long walk and you don't even know if it was raining.
Mm-hmm.
She'll give you no texture.
Nothing. No.
And that may be why they adapt well to movies, because the movie writers, the script writers go, I can have a great time with this.
Oh, no, totally.
She wrote the dialogue.
She wrote the script, and then the cinematographer is like, yes.
Yes. And then the costume designer goes, oh, brocade. I love brocade.
I'm all about it.
And they're all about it. And the same, but he conjures the fogs and the cobblestones in a way that, and it's a cliche to become enamored of the Victorian era for the images, but that's what drew me in. And then I fell in love with Darwin and Dickens and George Eliot.
Mm-hmm.
But the doorway, the wardrobe, the wardrobe through which I went into history. I pushed past the coats, and it was Victorian London through Sherlock Holmes. And then from there, I went a little this way and a little that way. And history then was like translucent and shimmering. And in the textbooks, and when you're in the sixth grade, the textbooks, and I was in the sixth grade a long time ago, the textbooks were a recitation of wars and a mention of presidents and prime ministers. And it just seems as gray as Soviet architecture.
Sure.
And you think, you just
or a
don't
funeral
go
home
there.
Built in 1972.
Yes. And there's one of those just down the street from the tiny town where I live.
Fun.
But he has the magic.
He does.
And you look around at writers now and you think, who is bringing everything alive? Junot Diaz is bringing things completely alive.
Mm-hmm.
Toni Morrison, in a very distinctive way.
I'm obsessed with her. Yeah.
And there are people who just, they've got the magic.
They do.
And
do you think that one of the reasons that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was so disparaging of Sherlock Holmes was because it was so popular and he didn't believe that important things should be popular? Or do you think that, and this is not an either or question, but it could be, you know, obviously an amalgam, do you think that he actually realized that it was personal and that it was about him in a certain way, and that true literature should be about some sort of platonic ideal of what a book ought to be? because I've had this conversation with many people.
That he know, had a, he had a, an ideal.
He had a platonic ideal of what
a book. He did not embody that ideal.
I know a lot of people who set out to write novels, who say, I'm going to write the next great work of American literature. And you're like, good luck.
Yes.
And then
yes.
they write like 20,000 words because they think it has to be this amazing thing. Yeah. And it's purely shit.
Yes.
900% of the time. Whereas if they were to sit down and say, I love dragons.
Yes. Yes.
Then if they wrote a dragon book and they're like, I have a lot of feelings about dragons. I have a lot of personal yes. emotions yes. that I can put. You know what I mean? Like on the one hand, Sherlock Holmes became very, very egalitarian and populist very, very quickly. So that yes. may have been a thorn in Sir Arthur's side, apart from the dollar bills, let's be real.
Sure, sure.
But on the other hand, I think that also this is something that he would imagine was not art because it was him.
Yes.
In some ways. And I don't know.
And I think about this when you were saying like how people sit down to write something great and fabulous. And I think about what Ray Bradbury said that he did that let him get past being derivative. He said he was derivative of Henry Kuttner and C.L. Moore and H.P. Lovecraft and everybody. Until he sat down and he would get up early in the morning by himself, speak to no one, and type the first word that came to mind, which was an image, dandelions or the porch. And that would be the boarding house his family owned and rented, where he met so many strangers coming through. And he would then sit there and conjure the memories that word brought about. And it's a very unusual and distinctive way to do it. So at his best, he did things that were like nobody else. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I mean, he did a lot of later stuff where it was kind of...
Oh, his short stories are stunning.
But his short stories at the best are yeah. just really distilled, weird, individual things. Mm-hmm. And you think, what more do you want? You embodied your own individuality. And his way of doing that just killed me. And so over the years, I really wanted to learn. I'm not writing fiction, except that single Sherlock in pastiche that you mentioned that's in that anthology.
I have to mention it because... All the best people write Sherlock Holmes passages.
Yes, yes. When I look around at the groups of people who are in these anthologies, and then Les Klinger and Laurie King said, will you do one for us? And I immediately said, oh, yes, I'd absolutely love to. And that's after thinking, oh, my God. And then I thought that Silver Blaze takes place at roughly the same time as a Black Beauty.
Oh, absolutely.
And so I thought, what if I retold Silver Blaze from the point of view of the horse?
So awesome.
In the voice of Black Beauty. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, okay, now this is my little corner. I can do this.
Totally.
But in general...
In the Venn diagram of your reading life.
Yes. There's a hot little spot right in the middle where these things happen.
It's molten,
you know,
yeah.
And we've sure. started, you know, historical fiction writers and nonfiction writers, and we talk about how you don't know the spontaneous combustion that will happen.
Yeah.
You put in all those newspaper archives, as you were saying. You put in, like I read travel guides to the areas I want to write about because somebody was on a train within the same month that Darwin, for example, as I'm doing now, was riding that train on that track in the same month and is writing about it in a travel guide or in a letter or something. And they mention things that Darwin had to have seen. In fiction, I would have him see them. In nonfiction, I just say they were there.
They were there. And he could have been reading the newspaper.
So. Sure. Yeah, he might
have. So you can't
exactly.
necessarily. Yeah.
Like
this is how, ladies and gentlemen, this is how meticulous Michael Sims is about only putting down what could have happened, not what did in fact happen.
I have to mention from Graham Bass's wonderful children's book, Animalia.
Oh, I love his book.
Animalia is one. He's great. And my five-year-old has learned the word meticulous.
I was obsessed with those when I was a kid.
Oh, they're fabulous.
Yeah, and you can just stare at them for ages.
Oh, like...
What's the other one that was big, that's been big for a long time? There's Animalia, but there was a second one.
He did, I think he's the one who did the Tuesday night thing where all the frogs yeah. are floating in the air.
Oh, it's gorgeous. Which is the one that's another. A mystery, though, that you have to find clues
yeah,
in the pictures.
Remember.
Oh, Grain Base, okay. Everyone.
Anyway.
Go get it.
Wow.
Yeah. So I'm really glad that she knows meticulous because...
This is wide-ranging.
I know it is. This is what Baker Street Babes podcast is.
And this is what I love about the Sherlockian community, speaking of Venn diagrams.
Right.
And you see it with like Henry David Thoreau when I did that or whatever, you get why different people are drawn to different things. And mm-hmm. it's not like, I've always said that a meeting of the Baker Street Irregulars or Sherlockian group is a cross between an academic conference and a toy show. Because it's the passion of the hobbyists combined with the scholarship. Then in the middle is that area of playing the game of imaginary scholarship. And just so many different things brought to this.
So many things. I want to, I'm not gonna bug you for too much longer because I know that you have a schedule today. I had never heard of the May 1892 issue of The Idler, in which it published, this is 1892, this is early, Detective Stories Gone Wrong, The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. And Sherlock Holmes is, for those of you listening to a podcast, since you can't see it, S-H-E-R-L-A-W, capital K, O-M-B-S, which is already amazing. And I quote, I dropped in on my friend, Sherlock Holmes, to hear what he had to say about the Pegram mystery, as it had come to be called in the newspapers. I found him playing the violin with a look of sweet peace and serenity on his face, which I never noticed on the countenances of those within hearing distance. Which is fantastic. And I love that you're already starting to incorporate, by the time you get about halfway through Arthur and Sherlock, you're starting to incorporate other people's interpretations and other people's reactions to the stories and, sort of the fanish response, and in a very jovial and like a loving way.
Yes.
Because this becomes a worldwide phenomenon. We all know the answer to this question is Sherlock Holmes going to be a successful character? Yes.
Yes. There's no suspense there.
There's no suspense. We're talking about a parody that happens in 1892. It's amazing because nobody will have read that.
Yes. 5 minutes, like O. Henry, everybody starts right off.
Mark Twain.
That was J.M. Barrie, right? I forget.
It was the editor of the publication of the
Idler. Who created Eugène Valmont?
Yes.
Who later created him, who seems to have somewhat inspired Agatha Christie to create Poirot.
There's all these cross paths. So you're already talking about fandom, like, in a sense, fandom very quickly in this book. And I could not recommend this book highly enough to people because it's awesome. So if you could just talk about that, how you started with something that was very, very small in the sense of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle met Joseph Bell and a seed was planted. And this is what his life was like. And this is how his life grew. And by the time you get further into the book, you're already talking about the widespread influence.
Do that as much as possible, like things that surprised me, like how hard it was to sell U.S. editors on it.
Sure.
Because the stories were the wrong length. They were more like 8,000 words instead of 5 and all those things.
Oh, tell me about it.
But I also, in this, like in Henry Thoreau or the A.B. White or anything else, I don't want to look ahead. I don't want to quote critics. I want to read all those things. And they're in the footnotes or whatever, but I want to stay only to that moment. So when I end with the publication of The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, my story has to be totally done in your mind and feel satisfying. Because I want all this, but I don't want to look even 5 minutes ahead. I want you to be right where Arthur Conan Doyle was on that day. Mm-hmm. And so I can't look ahead at fandom, but I can begin as soon as it starts.
Exactly. And it started so early.
Yes. Author of Peter Pan, friend of his. They later collaborate. O. Henry, very early. So many, because you can't get as colorful as Sherlock Holmes and not see how some people would want to parody it.
Of course.
And so now all those who love him, the parodies are fabulous. Like Robert L. Fish, who died just last year or earlier this year even, did Sherlock Holmes, those stories in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine.
Mark Twain did the double barrel detective story, which incredibly, I only just recently discovered, and I love Mark Twain and Sherlock Holmes.
There was a first edition of that in Otto Penzler's store last night.
Yeah, I bet there was.
I didn't even open for fear of
it. Did you do a line off of it just to smell it?
Yes,
and by
exactly.
A line, I don't mean cocaine. I just mean book smell.
Yes. Well, I didn't want to open the cabinet, but Les Klinger raised the glass. So I just sat down and leaned down and sniffed. He bought Jacques Futrelle's first edition of Jacques Futrelle's The Thinking Machine, signed by Vincent Sterrett.
Well, that's stunning.
Yeah. And again, you go, the generations, the whiff of this contagion.
Exactly. And I love that you reference that as it's happening, like in real time, as you were saying.
I really wanted, that's part of the question with the Darwin book, but in each of these, I didn't want to use any words created after the time of that story. And I want to sort of write my prose in the key, at least, of the original author. So like with Henry Thoreau, it had to be long, more Latinate, rambling paragraphs.
Not going to cook his own dinner. Ever.
Well, he did. This is a point that comes up a lot.
Yeah.
But he was going home all the time to like help cook at his parents' house.
Oh, at his parents' house, yeah.
And like bring in their firewood and do everything else. And so if his sister came over to bring him food, it would seem pretty even.
Yeah.
And he had this beautiful phrase, and then we're through with him, that he would go in every day to the village for a homeopathic dosage of gossip.
Oh, that's actually a great line.
So I forgot the point again.
it's just that in real time, you are incorporating people who love Sherlock Holmes into a book about how Arthur created Sherlock Holmes. And I think that that's really gorgeous.
It was really fun because I sometimes want to expand. I want to use everything we know now, but I don't want to look ahead. And it's also not the kind, they're narratives. I don't want to quote sources. All that's in the back.
If you
need them, they're backstage.
I feel like you don't want to taint the past with your own knowledge.
Yes. And so, like, I know I read a lot about diphtheria to understand what happened to Joseph Bell. And he wound up with it because he used a pipette to suck mucus out of a child's throat, a child who was choking to death.
Neat.
And so he rescued him and almost killed himself. So I learned a lot about diphtheria to understand what was happening here. But I couldn't tell you anything beyond what they knew at that time.
Sure.
And so then also when Arthur Conan Doyle poisons himself with doses of Josimbium, and damn near kills himself and writes this up as his first publication anywhere as a letter to the editor of the British Medical Journal about, I think I could have.
Dear sir, I almost died.
Dear sir, I almost died. And I think I could have done even more except for the diarrhea. And
sure.
This is your first publication.
Yeah.
So I learned everything about Josimbium, but I could only tell you what Arthur Conan Doyle had read to that point.
Of course.
Or what was known in America. And that is like you do in historical fiction.
It is.
That's the pleasure.
It is exactly that, because I only try to incorporate what anybody would have at the time contextually in terms of language, in terms of research, in terms of food, in terms of recipes that exist, music that exists.
Yes.
You know,
and movies get that wrong every day.
You do. And like, it is very difficult occasionally not to get it wrong. For example, I was informed by a Sherlockian and I imagine mutual friend, if not by actual personal acquaintance, then by reputation, Don Hobbs, who for a very long time before he donated it to a library had the largest collection of Sherlockian translations in the world of the canon. And, he pointed out to me at one point, he said, Lindsay, you described that color as mauve in 1845. And I said, yes. And he said, mauve is a synthetic color. And it didn't exist until about 20 years later. You can't even use colors to the extent that that one would imagine them, just as, I mean, who would think that a color was invented in a particular year, but it was.
And that there are books about that.
Oh, yes.
That my girlfriend mentioned like 3 days ago, that there's a book on the history of mauve, which I thought I need, because I have books called The Primary Colors, The Secondary Colors, you know, all this.
Oh, you need all of this.
So I need,
you need to write an entire book about colors.
Don't tempt me. It's so tempting.
I just want to thank you for having spoken at such length with me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, and, it was a great pleasure. Talking shop is always fun with somebody who really actually practices the same thing.
It's fun. It's super fun. Well, it's our honor to have you. You're now an honorary Baker Street Babe. This is, again, Michael Sims, the author of Arthur and Sherlock, Conan Doyle, and the Creation of Holmes. And he was nominated for an Edgar Award for Best Critical Biographical this year. And we're all very proud. Yay.
Thank you so much. This was great fun.
Thank you.
If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you 2 to 1?